The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merritt, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here with you on this fourth day of May 2025. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is with us as always. I'm glad you could join us tonight. We've got a special show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we will welcome in one of the greatest hitters in baseball history, the great Hall of Famer Rod Carew will join us. And in the second half, we'll switch gears, as we do occasionally, and welcome in the front man from the great band Zebra, Randy Jackson, will join us ahead of their show coming up at Westbury Music Fair. So sit back, relax, enjoy the show tonight. Let us paint the picture for you. We've got some great talk up ahead. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page. It's called The Talk of New York Sports. You'll find great photos, sports information, show information, so much more. Stop by, take a look. You can also follow me on X at BDonahueWGBB, all one word. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they're all out on the website the next day, www.sportstalknewyork.com. You can catch up anytime you want. So some good information for you there. Our first guest, he was American League Rookie of the Year in 1967, an 18-time All-Star, seven-time batting champ, AL MVP in 1977. He played for two teams, the Twins and the Angels, and he's had his number retired by both clubs, and he's in the Halls of Fame for each of those clubs as well. In 1991, he was immortalized by passing through the hallowed portals of the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. And my Marine Corps buddies out there would want me to mention that this man is also a United States Marine. Welcome back to Sports Talk New York tonight, Rod Carew. Rod, good evening.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
We're doing wonderful, and I want to ask you right off the bat, Rod, how are you feeling?
Well, I'm good. You know, I've had some different surgeries, so
right.
I just had my knee replaced.
Oh boy, yeah, I know that.
Almost 6-7 months ago, and besides that, you know, I had a heart transplant, kidney transplant, the whole works. But so, I'm doing okay.
That sounds good, Rod. We're glad to hear that, and I'd like you to tell the folks how you got the name Rodney Klein Carew.
Well, I was born on a train in Panama, and the lady that delivered me, you know, my mom was sitting in the back of the train.
Mm-hmm.
So, in those days, you know, the white folks rode up front and the black folks rode in the back. So,
yeah,
she was on her way to a doctor's appointment. And all of a sudden, I guess I decided I wanted to come out and see the world.
Right.
And so I was born on a train, and the lady that became my godmother was a nurse in New York, and she was back on vacation. So she started the delivery, and the doctor up front heard about the delivery and came back and assisted her, and his name was Dr. Rodney Klein. So my mother named me, you know, after the doctor. So he took care of me when I was a youngster back in Panama. And we didn't have to pay for anything. You know, it was his pleasure to do that.
Great story, Rod. Yeah, that is one in a million. I'll tell you that. Now, you have said in the past, Rod, that your career as a U.S. Marine was invaluable to your baseball career. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I joined the Marine Corps in 1965, so as a reservist, so I was in for about 7 years. I would go to two meetings a month and 2 weeks during the summer. So I wasn't able to play during that time. But, you know, it taught me how to discipline myself and concentrate on things that I needed concentrating on. You know, I was a combat engineer, so I always played with dynamites and fuses and learning to disarm mines and things like that. So I really had to concentrate and be disciplined about what I was doing.
Right, that's for sure. When you're handling that stuff, you certainly do, Rod. That is correct. Now, you had a penchant when you first came up for stealing home base. I read about a time where Mickey Lolich was on the mound. He balked, and Cesar Tovar was on the base with you. He stole home. Then you executed a double steal with Cesar. And who got you started on the stealing of home?
Well, Billy Martin did, you know, and I thought at first he was crazy because we were going to use a sign with the hitter, and hopefully, you know, I would flash the sign, and then the hitter would answer. Well, on one occasion, you know, I flashed a sign to Killebrew because we were facing the Angels, and the old knuckleball pitcher, Hoyt Wilhelm, was on the mound.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the first time that I tried to steal home early in the game. And as I was sliding in, Armin started his swing. So he jumped back and he held up and I slid across home plate.
And you made it.
I made it. But, you know, the object of the steal was to put us up by one run or in the late innings. And that was the earliest that I tried to steal home. So it became a big play for me and for the ball club and helped us tie some games up and or put us one run ahead.
And you have high regard for Billy Martin as a manager and a coach, don't you, Rod?
Yes, I do, because, you know, I learned a lot from him. I learned not to make alibis if I screwed up a play. He wanted me to admit it so that I would learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked with me at second base to improve my fielding. And he became my middle daughter's godfather.
Wow.
So that's how much I loved Billy Martin.
Great words about Billy Martin, folks. There you go. Now, I wanted to ask you, well, Rod Carew is with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. In July of 1977, you're on the issue, on the cover of Sports Illustrated with Ted Williams, and it says Ted Williams analyzes Rod Carew. Give us a recap of that. How did you work with Ted Williams? What did he have to say to you, Rod?
Well, you know, he thought that I should have hit with a lot more power. But, you know, when I signed with the Twins, they wanted a leadoff hitter. So playing Sandlot in New York, I used to hit the long ball quite often. So when I signed with the Twins, they wanted me on top of the lineup to get on base, steal a base, and set up a run scoring position, RBIs for the guys behind me. So I just changed my whole way of hitting and started using the whole field to hit and stopped swinging to hit the long ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that seemed to work out pretty good for you.
Yeah, I was lucky. You know, it's they give us two lines, and they didn't say you should try and pull everything or hit everything to the opposite field. So I went line to line, you know, and tried to keep the ball fair down the left field line or the right field line.
Right, okay. And incidentally, folks, in that summer of 77, Rod was also on the cover of Time magazine. So good press during that period, Rod, that's for sure. Now, how did you feel about moving from second base to first base and then later on as a designated hitter? How did those changes affect you?
Well, You know, I played second base. I got hurt at second base. Mike Hegan slid into me on a double play, and he kept me out for almost the whole season. So when Gene Mark came in 76, he said he wanted to move me to first because I almost got hurt again on a throw from the third baseman. And so I said, that's fine. I said, you know, it might be an easier position for me to learn. And, you know, I had to learn about the different infielders and their throws to first base. So he worked with me real hard every day and turned me into a pretty decent first baseman.
There's a name for you, folks. Gene Mock. Google Gene. A great manager.
One of the best.
Yeah.
One of the best.
There you go, folks. Yeah, Gene Mock, M-A-U-C-H, a great manager in his own right. Now, moving from Minnesota to the Angels, what prompted that, Rod?
Well, you know, Calvin Griffith came to me and called me up to his office, and he thought that I should have been making a lot more money, but he couldn't pay me. So he had a trade worked out with the Angels, the Giants, and the Yankees, and I took California because I had heard from couple of my former teammates that went out to California that Gene Autry was a heck of a owner. So that's one of the reasons I chose the California Angels. And they were able to get five players for me. So it was a good deal for me to be a part of the Angels organization.
Right. They got a pretty good haul for you. And how about joining the Yankees, Rod? How do you think you would have enjoyed that? That would have been some lineup with Rod Carew in it, folks.
Well, I would have enjoyed it, but, you know, they started calling the Yankees the Bronx Zoo, so
yeah.
I didn't want to be in a situation where, you know, they're battling all the time, and as much as I wanted to play in the World Series, I just decided that going out to California, I wouldn't be hounded by the press a lot, and I could just go out there and play the game and have
right.
fun playing the game.
Play your game, exactly. But I have to tell you, Rod, that any ex-Yankee that I talk to, they have nothing but good things to say about George Steinbrenner, and that's to a man. So just to give you a thought. These guys think that George was a great owner. So I don't know if that dissuaded you or not from the Yankees, but I read where they had a good package for you, too, including Dave Rigetti and Chris Chambliss to go to the Angels for you.
Well, to me, he was a baseball man.
Mm-hmm, right.
And he always was nice to me and talked to me whenever I played in New York. So, you know, I've got good things to say about him, nothing bad. But he wanted to always have the best team that he could possibly have on the field because New York is such a baseball country. And the Yankees organization has always been a top-notch organization. But I chose to, you know, go out to California.
Right. Yeah, that's one thing about George is winning came first with him. Now, I want to ask you, Rod, about August 4th, 1985. Frank Viola is on the hill at Anaheim. You got your 3,000th hit, which leaves you in great company with the history of Major League ball players. What did Viola throw you that day?
Well, he had two strikes on me, and he threw me a slider that was breaking down in a way, and, you know, I just stayed on it and just hit a line drive to left field. So it was a typical Rod Carew hit. You know, I never pulled the ball that much, but I could always handle the pitch away and try to hit it to left field or down the left field line or into left center. So it was a good pitch. If I had taken it, I would have struck out.
Oh, boy, yeah. So you had a beat on that one. Now, your stance, Rod, your stance could be described as being a little unorthodox. How did you start hitting in that particular stance?
Well, you know, I faced Nolan Ryan.
Right.
And I used to have my bat more above my head. And I always chased that high fastball, and I could never catch up on it. So I started experimenting in extra batting practice with different stances. So that's where that stance came from. Nolan Ryan striking me out 29 times. I'm number fourth on his list. And I felt I had to make an adjustment. So I just took extra batting practice, playing around with different ways of standing at home plate so that I could stay down on the ball. And that when I made my approach, I wouldn't come up. So it worked for me. And, you know, it's something that, you know, I experimented with.
Yeah, I can understand that. I didn't know that you were fourth on his hit list, so to speak, Rod, about Nolan Ryan.
The strikeout list.
Yeah.
I'm number four, yeah.
Wow.
But, you know, I was, you know, after I started with the new stance, he had problems getting me out. So he always used to yell at me from the mound to stand up. And I used to point down to the ground and say, just bring the ball down because I'm not chasing that high fastball anymore.
That's it. Yeah, good way to put it. Great story there with the great Nolan Ryan. We're talking with Rod Carew tonight on Sports Talk New York. We're lucky to have him with us. Now, getting back to your steals of home, Rod, you did it 17 times, and that ties you on the list with a guy by the name of Larry Doyle, who played for the New York Giants back around the 1910s, and also Eddie Collins. And I just wonder, you guys that are in the Hall of Fame, do you ever do any research or do you know guys like Eddie Collins? Do you realize some of the players that are in that very rare fraternity that you're in?
Oh, yeah. We always talk about the different guys when we have our Sunday dinner at the Hall of Fame. So, you know, when you're a baseball player, you always read up and the guys that played that came before you.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, you know, I did know about those guys, and George Case is one guy, too, that stole home quite a few times. So
a very fast guy he was.
Yes, he sure was.
Yeah.
And he was the coach with the Twins, and I used to talk to him about a lot about stealing bases and stealing home.
Do you have any good stories, Rod, about rocking on the back porch at the Otis Saga? And any great argument or great story from that particular time when you guys spend on the back porch of the Otis Saga Hotel?
Well, you know, it was always good to get together with the guys.
Yeah.
You know, I went to all the dinners at the Hall of Fame because, you know, I wanted to pay respect to the other players that were coming in. And we just used to sit out there and talk about the game and talk to pitchers and tell a lot of stories, a lot of lies, you know, and it was fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a great time. I know I had J.G. Taylor Spink Award winner Bill Madden on the show last week, and he was talking about Ted Williams and Tommy Lasorda got into it one time, and it was just a hilarious, hilarious situation. Now, you went on
well,
to be – go ahead, Rod. I'm sorry.
You know, Ted wanted everyone to hit like him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he couldn't handle the pitch that was down and away. And I made a living off of that pitch.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought that I should have stayed back a lot more and hit for more power. But I knew what my job was, so I just kept working at it until I was able to master it, you know, going to left center field and going up the middle.
Right, and that sure worked. You became a hitting coach with the Angels and I believe with the Milwaukee Brewers, Rod. And any of the methods used by guys who taught you along the way, did you incorporate any of the advice that was given to you along the way?
Well, there's one guy that tried to get me to pull the ball all the time, and I just wasn't a pull hitter. If we had the hit and run on, I would try and, you know, use my top hand more to pull the ball into the hole if the runner is going. But, we didn't have a lot of hitting coaches back then. You know, now today they have about three guys that's on each club. And, you know, I think they overload the players today as far as, you know, hitting goes.
Yeah, they have coaches to teach the guys to how to tie their shoes. You know, there's a coach for everything these days, like you say. Name a pitcher for us, Rod, that gave you fits. One guy that you looked out there and you said, oh, man, I got to face this guy today. I know Nolan Ryan was one of them. Let us know another guy.
Rudy May.
Oh, boy, Rudy May.
Rudy May could have tossed the ball up there underhanded, and I wouldn't do anything with it. Until one day in New York, Gene had me out of the lineup, so I went in, and I said, Skip, I want to play tonight. I'm going to get a couple hits off of this guy. And Rudy knew I was playing, so he looked over at the dugout and said I was going to go 0-for-4. Well, I kept telling him that I'm going to get a couple hits. And I ended up, I think, getting three hits that night. And after that, he never got me out as consistently as he used to.
Yeah. Rudy May, folks. There's another great baseball name for you. Now, in 2024, I think it was, Rod, you became a citizen of the United States. And what does that mean to you?
Oh, it means the world. You know, this country has given me so much and done so much for me. So, you know, I respect this country very much. One of the reasons I waited so long is I had made a promise to Mr. Torrijos back in Panama, and he was running the government. And he said to me that he's trying to get kids to stay in school and to play sports, and I would be a good representative for the country. So, you know, I kept putting it off until this past year. I decided that I was going to get dual citizen. But, you know, I'm proud to be an American now, because this is a great country. And, you know, I hate to see what's going on right now, but it's a place that I will never leave until I die.
Well, we're certainly glad that you're an American citizen, Rod. That's for sure. And we're all proud to call you an American citizen. Now, I want to ask you before we go, Rod, about your great teammate and friend, Tony Oliva. We've had Tony on the show a couple of times, once with his son Rick when he wrote his children's book. How's Tony feeling? We said that he's been having some health issues lately.
Yes, he just had a stroke, but he's doing good. You know, we were roommates for about 12 years.
Yeah.
And he taught me everything about playing the game, taught me how to dress, taught me how to tie my first tie. And I'm going to tell you, he's a great individual. He's one of the nicest guys you'll ever want to meet in the game or away from the game. So I was real happy when he was elected to go into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have him in the Hall. Finally, a very deserving man such as Tony Oliva, a great hitter in his own right, taking his place in Cooperstown. Well, Rod, it's been a real honor and a pleasure to have you with us tonight. I thank you for taking time away from your family to be with us on a Sunday evening. I want to thank your lovely wife, Rhonda, for helping set up our chat. And I hope to see you on Main Street in July.
Okay, and thanks. It was great talking to you. And I want you to know that I'm pulling for one of the former Yankee players.
Who's that?
Don Mattingly.
Yeah.
Donnie Baseball, because he deserves to be in there also.
Yes, yeah. There's a lot of Yankee fans that would go along with you on that, and we'll see what happens. It's up to the veterans committees, all these committees that the Hall of Fame has now. Have they ever asked you, Rod, to be on one of the committees?
Yes, they have. You know, I was on the one that Jack Morris got in on.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And also on Jim Cott and Tony Oliva. But I couldn't do the one for Tony and Jim Cott. So I called Bert Blyleven because, you know, he was in there. And I said to him, I'm going to have you pinch hit for me this weekend. And you got to get those guys in. And sure enough, he did a great job in getting Jim Cott and Tony Oliva elected.
Two former Twins. Two great former Twins. That is great. Great story. The Dutch Master, Bert Blyleven. We've had him with us, Rod. Another great gentleman. And once again, Rod, thank you for coming with us tonight, and we hope you enjoyed yourself.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And it was good to see you, and I'll see you on Main Street.
We will. Well, I'll be looking for you, Rod. Thanks so much. That is the great Rod Carew, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll switch gears, as we do on occasion, and we're going to speak to the great guitar player and frontman from Zebra, Randy Jackson. So stick around, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Welcome back to Sports Talk New York on WGBB, AM FM radio live. We're live from beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island, New York. And we're glad to have you with us tonight. Great conversation with the immortal Hall of Famer, one of the greatest hitters in baseball history, Rod Carew. It was great to have Rod aboard, and just want to mention the Mets are losing. It's not a groundbreaking event, but I just want to mention that. They had a kid on the mound today called Blade Tidwell, straight from Syracuse, made his major league debut, a former Tennessee Volunteer. A lot of kids come from that program in Tennessee. But we'll keep our eye on Blade to see he makes any noise for the Mets coming up. Well, our next guest, born and raised in New Orleans, a member of the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame as well as the Long Island Music Hall of Fame. He's best known to us as the front man for Zebra. And Zebra will be performing at the Westbury Music Fair on Saturday, May 17th, coming up. I welcome to the show tonight Randy Jackson. Randy, good evening.
Hey, Bill, how are you doing?
We're doing great, Randy. Great to have you aboard. Now, I want to mention right off the bat, I tried to get you on the show one Super Bowl Sunday, and you politely declined because you wanted to watch the game, as most of the people I try to get on the show on a Super Bowl Sunday do. Now, we'll talk a little sports right off the bat. What teams do you support, and who have been your sports heroes throughout your life?
Well, I'm from New Orleans, so the Saints were always a big part of my sports background.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, being from Louisiana, Terry Bradshaw was a big, you know,
right.
hero. Pete Maravich. playing basketball. He was just awesome.
More people should think about Pete Maravich. He was just a tremendous ball player from LSU.
Yeah. So, really big. And you know, and I still remember, John Gilliam running back the opening kickoff at the first Saints game for a touchdown against Los Angeles.
Yeah.
My father had tickets, and we went to that game, and, I thought, okay, well, we're going to the Super Bowl. I was very young and very naive.
Well, I'm still naive, Randy, because I'm a Jet fan, so I'm still taking it on the chin since 1969 when they had their wins, but like I tell the kids, you never give up on your team. You always stick with them, and it's been killing me. It's been killing me every year since. Now, I want to ask you, Randy, as a young musician, what first gravitated you toward playing the guitar?
I think it was my parents taking me to see the Beatles.
Ah.
I mean, I knew about the Beatles, and I was excited to go to the show, but actually seeing them live and just seeing the reaction they got and learning about the music got me into it. And so I, from then on out, music was definitely on my, on my radar for something I'd like to do.
Now, I guess you'd say that your early influences were the Beatles. Any other bands that influenced your style?
Yeah, once I started really playing guitar, I listened to a lot of Allman Brothers, Cream. Mm-hmm. This is all late 60s. Jimi Hendrix is a big influence, Grand Funk. I listened to a lot of Mark Farner. And, of course, Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We've had Mark Farner on the program. He's a really good man, really nice guy. Some of your early gigs where you first got your chops, where'd you play in the beginning?
Well, in the beginning, we played local clubs in New Orleans. And we played some dances. They had a CYO, Catholic Youth Organization, dances.
Mm-hmm.
And, we kind of learned what we were doing the first 2 years down there, playing those venues, before we came to New York. Once we got to New York, there were a lot of clubs we were playing. We were fortunate enough to open for a lot of bands who were already established in Long Island. And we played at Hammerheads in Levittown and
right. The
Mad Hatter in Stony Brook, Speaks in Island Park. There's a place in Queens called Beggar's Opera.
Beggar's Opera, yeah.
Yeah.
The Clipper in Bayshore, how about that place?
I don't know if we ever played the Clipper.
Yeah, you did, because I walked in there one time and I saw the two guitars and the drum set sitting there, and I said, Zebra's playing tonight.
Okay, well, you got a better memory than me.
Yeah.
I don't remember all of them, but there were a lot of different little clubs. One I remember over in that area was Chaucer's in Oakdale.
Yeah.
Remember that place?
Stanton Anderson used to play there a lot. Yeah, Chaucer's,
yep.
Boogie Ballroom, and then it was the Ale House or vice versa. Yeah, right on Montauk Highway. Yeah. Do remember Chaucer's. And the band Shepherd's Bush, Randy, take us through that, how it eventually gave way to Zebra.
Well, Shepherd's Bush was a band that was formed by Felix Hanneman and his roommate, Eldridge Madaire, at the time. And they wrote some songs, and they were putting the band together, and they needed a lead guitarist. And I knew Eldridge. Eldridge was working at a bar that I was working at, a bar called The Library in New Orleans. And, he had seen me play, and he asked if I wanted to, try out for the band. And I met with Felix, and, we got together. We started playing. We filled out the band with a bass player and drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And we played together for about a year. But it was kind of my reintroduction to original music, because the last time I had written anything was when I was like 8 or 9 years old.
Wow.
And the reason that I wrote back then was because I couldn't play anybody else's stuff. So all I could do was write my own songs, And so I actually wrote the first couple of songs I had with the girl that brought me the first Beatle record I had, And then after that, I was just learning stuff, learning other people's music and getting my chops down. And then, joining the Shepherd's Bush really got me back into writing again. So
yeah, that's a great name. I know Shepherd's Bush is a neighborhood in London, and There's a BBC studio there. That's about all I know about Shepherd's Bush. How did the band get the name Zebra, Randy?
We were desperate for a name because we had a gig that was coming up real quick, and we had sort of kind of reluctantly taken the gig, but we were ready. But we just didn't have a name, and we met at a bar up in uptown New Orleans near Tulane University, and we threw names at each other, and none of them stuck. And as we were leaving the bar, there was a picture of a zebra. It was actually a Vogue magazine cover from 1926, and there was a zebra with a woman riding it with a dress from the 1920s. And said, hey, let's call it Zebra. That sounds good. And that was it.
And it worked.
It worked, yeah.
Now, we talked about the club scene back in the 70s and 80s. Like I tell people, there was a bar on every corner, and there was a band in every bar. That's the way it seemed on the island. And I love that period. I grew up in that period. I love to talk about it. I've had J.J. French on the show, John the Cat Gatto, guys like that from the local bands. What bands did you enjoy back in the day? I don't know if you got to see many bands or you played with any of them. What Long Island bands did you like, Randy?
I mean, the first band we played with when we got up here was Rat Race Choir.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved them. I mean, before we saw Rat Race, all we knew about New York was the New York Dolls. And, you know, we had seen them in New Orleans at a place called Ball and Jacks, and they weren't doing too good at the time, you know. But and we had met the Good Rats, and the Good Rats were a great band doing all original stuff. But when we got here and saw Rat Race Choir, they were really progressive and just monster musicians. So that was an impressive band for us. There was a band called Essence. I really liked.
Yeah.
I enjoyed going to see Twisted Sister because they were just so outrageous, you know? And it was, you know, everybody loved it. I mean, they just balls to the wall, no holds barred, you know, it was really great stuff.
It was a great time back then for music.
Yeah, there was a band called Harpy.
Yeah, Harpy, that, I remember them.
It was kind of theatric.
Yeah.
Great band. I know a lot of bands, you know, I could go through a whole list, but you know, the great part about it was that the scene was so, you know, lively. It was that you had bands playing five nights a week.
Yeah.
And there weren't enough bands to go around. Everybody was opening clubs, and it was diverse.
Like you say, you had a theatrical band like Harpy, you had Rat Race Choir, and then you could go down the street and see the Southern Cross Band.
Or Stanton Anderson, like you said.
Yep, great time. Now, you guys eventually signed with Atlantic. How did that go down?
Really lucky. We had made demos back in 1979, and the manager we had at the time had shopped the demos to several labels, including Atlantic, and we had been turned down. And told by Atlantic that... you know, our music was dated. If we'd have come there 10 years earlier, it would have been great. They would have signed us, but, you know, today we had missed the train.
Oh, man.
So anyway, you know, we had Bob Buckman, who was the program director at WBAB, took a real interest in the band and started playing our demos on the air. He started out by playing them on Homegrown, and then started running them in regular rotation at the station, and we got, you know, most requested songs, you know, at the station. And nobody could buy them, so you had to call it to request them, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, as it turned out, there was a young guy from Atlantic who just started named Jason Flom, who went to the WBAB for some business and talked to Bob Buckman. And Bob brought up Zebra and told him about the statistics on Zebra and how well we were doing with the airplane stuff. And so Jason took a tape back to Atlantic. There was a new president of Atlantic. Doug Morris had just become president of Atlantic. And he took the tape in his car, limo, on the way back to his home. And he puts the tape in, and the story goes, we didn't find this out until a couple of years later, that he puts the tape in, and he's listening to the first song on the tape, and it's Who's Behind the Door, and there's like a long intro, acoustic guitar,
right.
No singing, for, you know. And so he just listens to it for about 30 seconds and ejects the tape. And the radio station happens to be tuned in to WDAB, so when he ejects the tape, the song's still playing, because it just happens to be playing in that song. And he's a little confused, puts the tape back in, realizes he's listening to the same song, and then just ejected it and listened to it on the radio. And, you know, the DJ says that's the most requested song at the station. And, you know, next thing we know, we're getting a call from Atlantic. You know, you guys are, this is brilliant. We want to sign you.
Nice, yeah. And I could see that happening, that Bob Buckman took the request papers, or however they kept them, the request list, to Atlantic and showed them exactly what the listeners wanted. And he used to say, listen to your listeners because they will help program your radio station. And there it goes, right there.
Absolutely. I mean, we kind of did the same thing with our original material when we first came out. We would just play it. We wouldn't announce that it was our songs. We would just play them in the middle of sets. And then if we got feedback, good feedback or bad feedback, we would know which songs to keep and which songs to kind of let go, you know?
Right, yeah, yeah. Good way. Now, the recording of the debut album, Jack Douglas produced that. How important was Jack to the recording process of that debut album?
Well, we were excited to have him. He had just won Producer of the Year for Double Fantasy. He was at the top of our list for producers that we wanted. And, you know, he brought a lot to the table. I mean, one thing that's great about Jack is that besides being an engineer, a great engineer, he's a musician. So he speaks the language, you know, all around, you know, whether it's technical with the equipment in the studio or musical. And he had a lot of great musical ideas. So, you know, we would incorporate that. And he had a great sense of humor. That was another thing. I mean, it's one thing to have somebody that really knows what they're doing, but you want to enjoy it. And
right.
He's a lot of fun to be around. He's actually producing five of the songs on the new Siva record we're doing for this year.
Interesting. Yeah, that's great. Now the follow-up album to the debut, there were two of them, I believe. What do you recall about the writing and recording and the reception of those records?
The second record, I wasn't ready for. You know, we had gone out on the road with the first record. It was successful, you know, having a great time. I'm just kind of continuing doing what we were doing in the club days, which was partying a little too much. And so when we got off the road and then, you know, Atlantic's asking for the next record, I had to kind of go back and now I'm assembling stuff that I'd already written years earlier and putting another record together, you know. I should have written more stuff on the road. The only song I actually wrote between the first album and the second album was a song called Lullaby. Uh-huh. But the rest of the record was songs that just maybe didn't get on the first record, like Bears and Wait Until the Summer's Gone. But there was a lot of other stuff, too. Guy's wife at the time wrote part of the song, But No More, wrote the middle section. So as an album, I think it's the most diverse album that we have as far as music goes. And I think that comes from the fact that, you know, we were just pulling, you know, songs from all over the place at that point.
Yeah.
When we released the record, the problem was, one of the main complaints was that the DJs were saying they couldn't hear the vocal or they couldn't understand the vocal. And the song was Wait Until the Summer's Gone, which is hard to understand what I'm saying anyway. But we went back in the studio, rushed back in, and we put another vocal on that was louder and sent it back out. But I think by then the anticipation had waned and, you know, it was a little bit too little too late. We put out a couple of other songs, and it just didn't happen. We toured with Sammy Hagar, and that helped give us a lot more exposure. But the record just never really took off like the finish line.
Zebra was always a steady presence on the live scene. But you guys have been kind of dormant lately as a studio band. Has that changed? Or are you guys going to get back into the studio?
Yeah, like I said, we've been recording the last year now, working on the fifth Zebra record, five albums in 50 years.
And, that's okay.
And like I said, Jack Douglas is going to be producing, you know, a large part of the record. And it's sounding great. We're going to be playing some of the new songs at Westbury. And we just debuted them down in Texas a couple of weeks ago, and they went over great. So that was a relief. People seemed to like them. And we're hoping we get the same response at Westbury.
How was the writing? Who did the writing on the new record, Randy?
I wrote, you know, part of at least every song, but I pulled some songs from back when I was doing the China Rain record, which was a solo record I did for Atlantic back in 1990. So I got a song that I wrote with Mark Mangold. I got a song that I wrote with Mark Hitt, the guitar player from Rat Race Choir. You know, we wrote a lot of stuff together. So there's several songs with different writers on. And so people will see, you know, it's going to be a great record. You know, we just took the best. I think we took the best of what was available and we put it together, and it's really sounding good.
Good. That's good. The Long Island Music Hall of Fame, Randy Jackson's with us tonight from Zebra. 2012, you go into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame. How meaningful was that to the band, given its history as a local band?
Well, I mean, the rules at the time were that, you know, you had to be from Long Island, you know, born and raised.
Yeah.
So they kind of made an exception for us, which we were very flattered by. And but a lot of people thought we were from Long Island anyway. I mean, there were so many people along the way that would say, yeah, I went to school with you or your brother, you know, Captain Merrick or something like
that. Yeah.
I said, yeah, it's impossible, you know. But you never know. Stories get made up. And but it was, yeah, we were very flattered. And, you know, it's great to have to be in the Hall of Fame in two different locations, really, our two homes.
Where are the guys living? Where are you guys at right now?
Living?
Yeah.
Well, I live in Long Island. Felix is living in Long Island. And Guy, our drummer, lives down in Covington, Louisiana, which is just north of New Orleans, just across the Lake Pontchartrain.
And where do you guys practice?
We're going to be doing rehearsal like next week. Guy will be coming up a couple of days early, and we'll be rehearsing for the Westbury show. We did some rehearsals down in New Orleans before we went to Texas a couple of weeks ago. So somebody's got to travel to do the rehearsals.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, a lot of it's just, you know, learning the songs and getting together and doing them. But, you know, hashing out the harmonies and figuring out how to do it with three people requires us really getting together and working that kind of stuff out. So
as I said, Zebra's at Westbury Music Fair on the 17th of May coming up. It's a Saturday night, folks. You mentioned some of the stuff from the new record, Randy. What else can folks expect from you guys at Westbury that night?
You know, they'll hear what they want to hear. The, you know, the classics we'll do, and we're going to do like a variety of stuff from all 50 years. You know, there's a lot of music to cover. You know, even though there's only four studio records, we've got other stuff that was on live records that was never on a studio record. We've got some songs that were on a greatest hits record that were never released, so we can pull from all that, and there's more than enough for the night, I guarantee, you know.
That sounds great.
I think it's going to be a good show. I think people are going to really like the new material. So
is it going to be early enough that the old folks can get home?
Yeah, I mean, Westbury is never a late affair. I think the curfew there is 11 p.m., so.
Yeah, everybody will
be home in
bed. I don't
think you have to
worry. Yeah. Yeah. We're not as young as we used to be, Randy, so that, you know.
No.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Randy Jackson, it's been a pleasure having you with us. Thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here at Sports Talk New York. Don't forget, folks, Westbury, May 17th, Zebra Live coming at you guys. And thanks again, Randy.
Bill, thanks for having me.
That is the great Randy Jackson, ladies and gentlemen. We will be right back after this.
Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Great to have you with us tonight. Bill Donahue here with you on this Sunday evening, May the 4th. And I won't say May the 4th be with you, Brian, because I'm not a nerd. And that's all nerd situation. So we have word that Edwin Diaz is in the game for the New York Mets. So I don't know if you think that's a good idea or not. The Mets are down. I hope this is not part of a downward spiral that's going to continue for the season here. I was out there this week, and tough game out there, and big crowds at Citi Field this year, and coming off the success of last year, it's easy to see that. So that's it from the New York Mets. I thank you guys for joining me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests, the great Rod Carew and Randy Jackson, my engineer Brian Graves, as always, and you guys for joining us. I'll see you next on Sunday, May 25th, for more Sports Talk New York. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
Program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.